Hello everyone, welcome back, Happy New Year. It's a really great pleasure for me to introduce Professor Vinita Damodaran, who is a friend. I was trying to think back to actually the first occasion when we met, which was with Vinita's husband, Richard Grove, when I was a graduate student. There was a conference in geography, I think, where you were speaking and he was speaking. It gave rise to Nature's End later,
yes.
A book edited by Paul Ward and others. And I was just really taken with this very intense engagement which I had with Richard and with you at that point in time. And it's been really nice being in touch with you since then. Vinita is a leading environmental historian writing in Britain today. And of course, she works on South Asia. Her work crosses environmental history with social and political history on the one side, but it's also fundamentally interdisciplinary. This is evident, for instance, in her two recent publications, and I'm just struck with the very different titles, East India Company and the Natural World, which is an account of the East India Company and its botanical gardens and other institutions, which was co-edited, and then also Climate Change and the Humanities, which I haven't looked at actually, but which I should look at, that came out last year, which is an interdisciplinary account drawing in scientific studies as well, if I understand correctly.
History and philosophy.
And Vinita is the director of the Centre for World Environmental History at the University of Sussex, and we look forward to her paper, A Scientific Life. Thank you, Vinita, for coming and addressing us.
Great, thank you very much. So it's a pleasure to be among in Cambridge again. You know, I used to be a student here years ago and a research fellow, and it's always very nice to be welcome back and talk, particularly on this project, which is close to my heart. I'm just trying to complete a collection of annotated letters on Ikea Janakiamal, and it's a great pleasure to introduce you to her life and her scientific work. I'll read a little bit and I'll talk to my PowerPoint to keep it good time. So I first came across Janakiamal when I was looking through a massive volume edited by W.L. Thomas, Man's Role in Changing the Face of the Earth, University of Chicago Press, 1956. This volume emerged in the context of 1955 and 1956, which were critical watershed years in the evolution of post-war environmental history, in particular with the holding of W.L. Thomas's landmark meeting at Chicago and the resulting volume with the same title. It also saw the beginnings of Indian ecological history, the appearance of Clarence Glacken's first book, The Great Luchu, and the publication of W.G. Hoskins, The Making of the English Landscape, the latter being perhaps the first major environmental history to be written by a historian. The Chicago meeting, which opened on 16th of June 1955, was sponsored by the Rena Gren Foundation for Anthropological Research and had been planned for 3 years and was encouraged particularly by Carl Sauer and Lewis Mumford. The foundation's interest in calling the 1955 symposium was, I quote, to keep abreast of all the means at man's disposal to affect deliberately or unconsciously the course of his own evolution. In this case, what man has done and is doing to change his physical, biological environment on the earth. So this is the idea of the environment in 1955. It's a major conference on anthropogenically introduced climate change. So it's quite a revolutionary sort of new idea. What is interesting that the papers presented to the Chicago meeting were largely written by white Anglo-Saxon men. But there was one very important exception, that given by E.K. Janakiamal, a distinguished woman geneticist and global plant geographer, a professor of botany at Madras, and co-author of the Chromosome Atlas of Cultivated Plants. The latter was already a famous work, and one which uniquely qualified her to comment on the evolution of plant distributions and human impacts upon them. But her contribution, and later this became a volume, as I said, the Thomas volume, was to essay an environmental history of subsistence agriculture in India, paying particular attention to the sharp difference between patriarchal, matriarchal, and tribal or indigenous Indian agronomies. Amal can be said to have pioneered both indigenous and gendered environmental approaches to land use history. The neglect of her contribution to environmental history and the history of science is notable, as she was to become a well-regarded and important scientist both during the Raj and in the post-independence period. So there's a picture of the young Amal there for you from the John Innes Center. And this is what I'm going to be doing in this presentation, which is contextualizing Amal within the historiography of science and looking through those particular themes of how she negotiated the boundaries of caste and race, how she encountered the patriarchy of science in Britain and India, the making of a national scientist, eugenics, and when she encountered Darlington and Haldane, two very well-known geneticists and eugenicists in some sense. Of Haldane can be seen to be at the right of the eugenics movement, Darlington was, at the left of the eugenics movement, Darlington can be seen to be at the right of it. We'll also be looking at networks, national and international, and the constitution of science at the end of empire, and finally looking at Janaki Amal's retirement and environmental activism in the context of the Silent Valley. So in recent decades, environmental historians have begun to map the intellectual history of their discipline, while historians of science have come to appreciate the role of science in the making of nations. Until 60 years ago, the history of science and the history of colonialism was studied separately. And it's only by the 1970s that there was emergence of a social history of science, leading to a growing interest in the structure and practice of science more globally. Historians such as Roy MacLeod, Richard Grove, and Satpal Sangwan, and their early incursions into the science of the Raj, started to unravel the complex matrix of British imperial science in India, all of them finding it necessary to overturn Louis Pynson and George Bessellar's portrayals of colonial science as a handmaiden of metropolitan science. Much of this work focused on reinstating the scientific contributions of colonial scientists who were seen mainly as settler scientists, such as William Roxburgh, Nathaniel Wallich, Robert Kidd, and the others, who were employed in the Calcutta Botanic Gardens in the 18th century. It's also important to note that much of what we think is Western science was produced in the colonies rather than being exported to them. Colonial expansion was thus crucial to the development of field sciences such as botany and zoology. Interest in indigenous responses to Western science show how Indians selectively approached Western science during the colonial period, with some revivalists attempting to regenerate Indian scientific traditions, while others embraced Western reason and science. However, it was not a level playing field for scientists in the Western tradition. As has been argued, a distinction came to be made between settler scientists and native scientists, and the latter were highly discriminated against in the late 19th and early 20th century by the colonial establishment. In 1920, P.C. Ray, who pioneered the Indian School of Chemistry, could count only 18 Indians out of 213 scientific personnel in 11 colonial scientific enterprises. V.V. Krishna quotes J.G. Medlicott, the head of the Geological Survey of India, who held the view in the 1890s that Indians were incapable of any original work in the natural sciences. In the early 20th century, J.C. Bose, a creative physicist who later moved into plant physiology, fought a lifelong struggle for scientific recognition in the West and was thwarted throughout. Interestingly, he also came to have come up against the jealousy of his own colleagues. Much of this historiography focuses on the contribution of native male scientists. And apart from a recent collection, they remain silent on the role of women in the history of Indian science. There is a new collection, which is an important addition to the history of science in India, which represents some of the missing women in Indian science, but it does not really talk about E.K. Janaki Amal. So this paper attempts to redress this lacuna in environmental history and the history of science in India by focusing on the life and scientific contribution of Janaki Amal. By situating her work and career within the context of the period, one can argue that whilst it is possible to see early nationalist science in India as gradually being dominated by the discourse of scientific industrialism in the 1950s, the vision for India's future sprang from many sources, including paradoxically those that sought to regenerate India's ecological and medical traditions. In this sense, as I said, Amal was a pioneer. Her career started as a botanist and cytologist, where she worked with C.D. Darlington at the John Innes Institute from 1940 to 1945. It was here that she studied the origin and coevolution of cultivated plants, resulting in the Chromosome Atlas of Cultivated Plants, which she co-authored. with Darlington, and which became an important source for cytological work on the economic plans of the world. So there were about 10,000 plans whose cytological work that they did together. And it became a phenomenal sort of study. On her return to India in 1951, she became a leading scientist of the nation who wanted to create a national system of generic science. She was able to do this as the first director of the Central Botanical Laboratory of the Government of India at Lucknow. She was to become the Fellow of the Linnean Society of London, the Royal Geographical Society, the Asiatic Society of Bengal, the Royal Asiatic Society of London, and the Indian Academy of Sciences. She did not become a Fellow of the Royal Society, and that was very, very sad to her right till the very end. And that's quite interesting, again, the marginalization of women in the Royal Society until 1945. In fact, Janaki Amal was one of the founder members of the Academy of Indian Sciences and the first woman member. An honorary legion doctoris was bestowed on her in 1955 by the University of Michigan. And one of her contemporaries, scientific contemporaries, C.S. Subramaniam, who was the director of the Center for Advanced Study at the University of Madras, wrote about her passion for plants, crop plants, garden plants, plantation crops, medicinal crops, and tribal plants. He saw her as an original thinker, doing epochal work on intergeneric hybrids, such as Saccharum zea, Saccharum eranthus, Saccharum imperator, Saccharum sorghum. Her pioneering work was on the cytogenetics of Saccharum officinarum, sugarcane, and the interspecific intergeneric hybrids involving sugarcane and closely related genera such as Bambusa or bamboo. Her studies on chromosome numbers and ploidy, as he noted, were directed to ascertaining the role of hybridization in the evolution of flowering plants, work that she had started with Darlington. She was the first salaried female staff member of the Royal Horticultural Society at Wisley in 1944, where she undertook investigations of colchicine and its use in inducing polyploidy. The focus of her work on plant evolution continued after her return to India, where she worked on the genera Solanum, Datura, Mentha, Champagonum, and Dioscorea, besides a range of medicinal and other plants. As an officer on special duty entrusted with the task of reorganizing the Botanical Survey of India post-independence, she was to become a progressive national scientist. Though cytology was her forte, as noted by her contemporary Subramaniam, her work embraced genetics, evolution, phytogeography, and ethnobotany. The account of her life that follows takes as a starting point the view outlined in a study by G. Abhiram and Dorinda Outram that the personal life of scientific practitioners has a bearing on their work. It also builds on the notion explored recently by Lambert and Lester about the importance of individual trajectories as these ran across and thwart state archive paper trails, and the narratives of the subjects' lives that link together markedly different places, introducing a more explicit discussion of the complex spatiality of empire, as well as of imperial subjectivities. As they note, there has developed in recent times a more critical approach to biographical writings, which tends to reflect on the ways in which individuals become meeting points for influences, no longer static but mobile, effusive, decentered, a process, not a thing. By looking at a career such as Ammal's that spans different countries, helps shed light on existing historical debates on gender, nation, race, and science in the context of empire. The paper also makes a case for a less centered biography, I quote, that seeks to bring the background of her life into view. It is in this sense that biography continues to remain a powerful way of narrating the past. By a more considered reflective approach, rather than a standard chronological biographical narrative, I've chosen to sequentially prioritize the different networks and relationships and career-defining moments of Amal's life and see them as dynamic assemblages of relationships with other people, places, and organisms. So the context of empire in late 18th century India, whilst creating the repressive conditions of colonialism, did allow for what has been called equivocal encounters, opening up intermediate and indeterminate spaces and resulting in forms of subjectivity that complicate the now well-worn binaries of colonizer and colonized. Amal's individual trajectory was to be shaped by her positioning on the boundaries of caste and race. So she was born on the 5th of November 1897 to a so-called low-caste family in North Malabar, and she had a checkered ancestry. Her mother was the illegitimate child of an English civil servant, John Charles Hannington, of the Madras Civil Service, a member of the well-known imperial family who resided in India for some generations. Her father, who retired as a sub-judge of the Telesri Court in Kerala, came from an educated family of the Thiya caste. He was an employee of Hannington and had chosen to marry his illegitimate daughter once his first wife died. The elder daughter of Hannington from his Indian mistress was married to an Anglo-Indian and became Martha Fuchs. So she had a sort of very interesting positioning as a low-caste, mixed-race Indian. And she writes about the way in which her sisters and her siblings, there were several of them, she was one of 14, faced discrimination both within the caste community in Kerala among the Thiyas and between and also as a result of her mixed race from her white father. And it is keeping this in at the background, we need to understand how she comes to choose the life of science, and she moves away from her sisters who had opted for marriage. With it came geographical dislocation and an opportunity to move away from her constraining background in terms of gender, caste, and race. Her life in science had begun. Her marginal status as a woman and as a lower caste mixed race Indian was to be transformed in the process. It is possible to argue, as I said, that so individual a trajectory was made possible by her positioning on the boundaries of caste and race, and that the in-between spaces provided by that particular mixture of imperial sexuality and caste hierarchies informed her subjectivity. So it was while working at as a lecturer in Women's Christian College in Madras, she received the Oriental Barber Scholarship from Michigan, where she was granted a DSc in 1931. In India, and this is quite an interesting fact, in India, support for female education was slow in coming. It's in this context that it's quite amazing that Ammal's rise in these circumstances to the position of academic eminence is attributed to her tenacity in the face of caste, gender, and racial discrimination, and is a remarkable story. The professionalization of science in the 19th and 20th century had made it possibly hard, and particularly hard, for women to fit in. And it was at odds with domestic and familial life, even at the metropolitan centers of scientific excellence. Many scientific women had to choose an unconventional family life in these circumstances. Ammal, as a single, unmarried woman, was able to challenge established convention and to practice science in public institutions such as the John Innes Institute, the RHS in London, and the Botanical Survey of India, normally the preserve of men. This had not always been so. Jim Endersby has argued that the association between botany and women contributed to its low standing in the male-dominated councils of scientific societies like the BAS in the early period. It was only later that the professionalizing of botany led to the marginalization of women. For most of the 19th century, the Botanical Society of London and the Horticultural Society were the only societies that admitted women. Once professionalized, women in botany required a male mentor to ensure their rise, and Ammal was no exception. At Michigan, Ammal had worked under Harley Harris Bartlett, the professor of botany, and it was he who encouraged her to make contact with her next male mentor, who was, of course, C.D. Darlington, which signaled the start of a long scientific friendship. Darlington, 1903 to 1801, has been described by his biographer as belonging to the great school of British geneticists, evolutionists, and biological statisticians produced by the country, basking in the afterglow of the eminent Victorians, Charles Darwin and Francis Galton. His first cytological work, Recent Advances in Cytology, 1932, and his 1939 book, The Evolution of Genetic Systems, would be hailed by some as a fundamental contribution to evolutionary thought. Later in his life, Darlington would turn to the subject of human history, becoming one of the most fascinating and controversial exponents of the sociobiological approach to human culture. The scientific and sometimes personal correspondence between Darlington and Janaki Ammal is preserved in the Bodleian Library in Oxford and provides a remarkable insight into the nature of a very particular scientific relationship that spanned different continents and crossed gender and racial barriers. Her early letters to Darlington reveal an independent thinking young woman scientist with a great deal of self-respect and self-esteem. When she joined the John Innes Institute in 1931 to work with Darlington, she was joining one of Britain's most vibrant biological communities. The Institute had been founded in 1904 by a childless London merchant who had left over £300,000 to establish a school for the improvement of horticulture. By the 1930s, it had become Britain's premier institute for genetical research, contributing fundamental insights into the chromosomal basis of heredity and its role in evolution. In January 1931, Darlington was to begin writing his anti-Lamarckian masterpiece, Recent Advances in Cytology, and was a major force to reckon with in the field of cytogenetics. As head of the Department of Cytology, with 15 people studying under him, he had created the largest school of its kind in the world. One of these researchers was E.K. Janakiamal. On 29 May 1931, she wrote an introductory letter to him, noting that she was, I quote, anxious to do the cytology of the triploid eggplant. By the end of the year, she was working on Saccharum sorghum hybrids, noting eloquently, there's a terrific amount of variation in the F1s, and some of the dwarfs and pale fellows look as though they are aching to disclose something cytologically and genetically. Rather poetic. Darlington was typical of the scientific mentors of his period in that he was extending his largesse to female employees under him. He often formed intimate relationships with them, if only briefly. Janaki was to prove no exception, and in three of her letters to him, written in the 1930s, she indicates her emotional involvement with him. This was only to be a brief interlude, but the relationship was one that was to dominate her life. As noted by Abiram and Outram, the progressive attitude with some scientific mentors to women often related to some form of emotional involvement and led to collaborative scientific work. Women scientists tended to follow this route rather than taking on the precarious position in science that would have resulted in the absence of a male mentor. The voluminous correspondence is also indicative of the communicative networks of the time that connected individuals and institutions, shaping scientific thinking and personal sensibilities. Other letters to Darlington followed, this time from India, where she had returned in 1932, and from the Imperial Sugarcane Institute in Coimbatore, where she was working in 1934. I shall try to accomplish something in Saccharum cytology so as to get an open session to the USSR. My new microscope arrived last week, she wrote. Despite her active work in the field, Amal faced several hurdles for the male scientific establishment in India and in Britain, which I'll point out. For example, from T.S. Venkatraman, head of the Sugarcane Breeding Institute, 1912 to 1942. In one letter in August 1938, I hope you can see that, she notes of the visit of the biologist Reginald Ruggles Gates to Coimbatore. It has taken 7 long months to undo the harm that Gates did in the course of a simple day spent in Coimbatore. Mr. Venkatraman was completely taken in by the professor's keen interest in the work done in Coimbatore, his fund of information and his gracious manner. Hence the doubt expressed not to me but to Venkatraman about the validity of the Saccharum Zia cross stuck in the expert's brain, and my note to Nature was not sent up to the Director of Agriculture for the necessary permission to publish it outside India. I very nearly decided to leave the station as a result of all this, and life became very complicated. However, I refused to be defeated, and I'm glad to report that Venkatraman is at last convinced that the cross is genuine. So this was a letter to Nature she was trying to publish, and it was, of course, being held up by her boss at the Sugarcane Institute. The note to Nature was finally published in 1938. The same letter indicated her unhappiness with continuing to work in the Imperial Council of Agricultural Research due to the lack of support for her publishing efforts. T.S. Venkatraman and C.A. Barber had initiated research in sugarcane breeding and had introduced drought-resistant Coimbatore canes, raising the prestige of the institute. However, Venkatraman, as head of the Sugarcane Institute, was not averse to blocking the work of Amal, either due to personal jealousy or a patriarchal stance. At the same time, Darlington was not above damning Janaki Amal's work with faint praise either. When John Russell, director of the Rothamsted Experimental Station, wrote to him on 10th of May, 1937, noting that he had met her in Coimbatore and inquiring, could you kindly tell me whether her work seems sound and whether it is simply in the nature of a student's exercise or can be dignified with the title of research? Darlington's reply was indicative of the lack of support, even jealousy, that Amal routinely faced within the male scientific establishment. The question of Janaki Amal, he wrote, seems to me to be part of a larger problem. Practitioners of cytology in India are very numerous, but cytological work of outstanding interest is unknown. The reason for this seems to be that Indians go in for cytology because they think it's a matter of technique and needs no thought otherwise. Therefore, when I say Janaki Amal understands her work better than anyone else, I do not mean to pay her a vast compliment. I think she is doing sound work and will continue to do so for some time, just because a great deal of elementary exploration in this field is necessary, and she cannot fail to be of value to the geneticists working with her. He further noted, I think it's a great pity that numbers of Indians come to this country to take PhD degrees in cytology just because they think it's an easy subject. And having obtained their PhDs, which they never fail to do, they return to secure a post in India. We refuse to take such people here, quote, close. Darlington's attitude to her here encompassed both prejudice against Amal's gender and her race, and was typical of the colonial attitudes of the time to Indian scientists in general, who were seen as lacking the capacity for creative and innovative research. Amal was critical of the fawning attitude of Indian scientists based at the Sugarcane Institute as well, especially that of Venkatraman, to British scientists such as Ruggles Gates. She had no sort of rose-tinted spectacles when she viewed the male scientific establishment. The view was in tandem with her increasing disillusionment with her own position. She was beginning to see herself, I quote, as the Cinderella of the Sugarcane Station. She had also started new work on Saccharum bambusa of hybrids, noted that they look more like sugarcane than bamboo. She found regular meiosis and discovered that they were fertile. And this work, as I said, was being published in very major articles at this time. At an annual meeting of the Indian Academy of Sciences, a creation of the Nobel Prize laureate C.V. Raman, she noted, it was jolly to get back amongst the few real scientists of India after the pseudo-scientific atmosphere of Coimbatore. The contrast between Raman and Venkatraman is very great. She looked to Darlington to receive a special invitation to attend the Genetic Congress at Edinburgh so that she could talk on Saccharum zea hybrids, and continued to complain about the hurdles in publishing her findings, given the resentment of Venkatraman to her work. It is interesting to note in this context that the jealousy of male colleagues with regard to work was based not only on gender grounds, but also on caste grounds. Amal may well have come up against the Brahmanism of the male scientific establishment in India, a feature commented on by another well-known Indian physicist, J.C. Bose, to Patrick Geddes in earlier decades. Bose wrote to Decades in 1917, you know that Brahmanism and priestcraft are not unknown in English science. The evil is far more accentuated here in India, where the number of scientific men are few and where wire pullers have succeeded in securing positions of authority, quote close. The 7th Genetical Congress took place from 23rd August to 30th August 1939 in Edinburgh. The Congress, usually held every 5 years, was 2 years late, the Russians having abandoned their plan to hold the Congress in Moscow in 1937. The suppression of genetics in Russia had already begun, and the Russians withdrew 10 days before the Congress. On Wednesday, the 23rd of August, 600 geneticists from 55 countries assembled in Edinburgh, and the list included Janaki Amal. By the end of Thursday, 24th August, international events began to take over. The German delegation was the first to leave, followed by the Dutch, Hungarian, Scandinavian, and Swiss. The Congress closed prematurely on the 29th of August, and Amal was unable to return to India for the duration of the war. Stuck in England, Amal worked for the duration of the war with Darlington at the John Innes Institute. He had become director of the institute in 1939, and in 1945, the collaborative work of Darlington and Amal. Sorry, I'm just trying to see if I can find that. The Chromosome Atlas of Cultivated Plants was published. This phenomenal study recorded the diploid chromosome number of some 10,000 species of flowering plants, including economic, decorative, and medicinal species. It became an important reference text in the economic and systematic botany, horticulture, and plant breeding. Amal left the institute in 1946 to join the Royal Horticultural Society in Wisley as the first salaried female member, undertaking investigations of colchicine and its use, in introducing polypleurdy. Her experience in cytology was beginning to be recognized in the metropolitan institutions of Kew and RHS, and she was sometimes called upon to report on newly discovered plants. For example, in one case, an Argentine couple claimed to have developed a grass with exceptional qualities, and this was passed on to Sir Geoffrey Evans at Kew, who in his reply stated that the grass was Sorghum halpinis, as identified by F.W. Ballard of the Herbarium. When Darlington sent the specimen to Janaki Amal, she differed from both the Argentine couple and Ballard, identifying the plant as the recently described Sorghum almum. In 1950, a second edition of the Atlas was proposed, but by now Janaki Amal was unwilling to be rushed into it by Darlington in what she considered an unworkable timescale. A row followed, with Darlington noting sourly that Amal did not wish to take part in the production of the second edition. Amal's response was swift. "You're right when you say that I do not wish to take part in the production of the second edition of the Chromosome Atlas. In my opinion, there's a whole year's work to be done before I'll be ready for a new edition. And you have asked for amendments for next January. Placed as we are geographically, and if I may be allowed to put it frankly, psychologically, collaboration will be most difficult, and rather than see it break down, I believe it is best not to attempt it." Quote close. Here was a scientist who understood the value of her work and refused to be rushed into something of a suboptimal standard by a senior patriarch in the scientific community. Darlington was by this time Sherardian Professor of Botany at Oxford, and he got A.P. Wiley at Manchester to assist with the second edition of the Atlas, which was published in 1955. Collaboration with Wiley was doubtless easier geographically, and dear professor, they acknowledged her contribution. Some of the most significant developments have been done due to the work of Janaki Amal, first in the Royal Horticultural Society Gardens at Wisley, and latterly with the Indian Botanical Survey at Calcutta. This incident and other battles with male scientists highlights Amal's scientific integrity and a growing independence from a one-time mentor, and the challenges she posed to the patriarchy of science, both in India and in Britain. The 1950s was a very important decade for Indian science, when nationalist scientists such as the noted chemist S.S. Bhatnagar and Meghnad Saha, an eminent astrophysicist who were part of India's scientific intelligentsia, were debating the future of Indian science. Autonomy from direct government interference and an emphasis on pure research was held by Saha as fundamental to the progress of Indian science. Saha noted pure science as a seed of applied science, and to neglect pure science would be like spending a large amount in manuring and ploughing the land, and then to omit sowing of any kind, quote close. However, S.S. Bhatnagar disagreed and sought to reorganize the Council of Industrial and Scientific Research, CSIR, founded in 1942 within the framework of a government-administered science. His views won India's first Premier Nehru over, and after 1947, though the CSIR continued to interact with universities, it was applied research that dominated its activities. The plan to meet post-war needs through the establishment of national laboratories was put into place. The first five national laboratories that were initiated were the National Chemical Laboratory, the National Physical Laboratory, the National Metallurgical Laboratory, the Fuel Research Station, and the Glass and Ceramics Research Institute. These were followed by the setting up of other laboratories, including the Central Botanical Laboratory, with which Amal was greatly involved. The alliance between India's political leadership and our scientific elite resulted in the culture of utilitarianism, driven by nationalist goals of self-reliance and import substitution. The embattled Saha predicted the fate of science in the universities if the part of a government-sponsored science policy of India was to be followed. The national laboratories which you have erected will not satisfy your needs. You have erected a temple, but you have not made any provision that there should be a constant influx of qualified votaries into the temple which will bring life into it. You must gird up your loins and find money so that you can render sufficient assistance to the universities and revitalize the activities. Amal believed in this, was very, very critical of the Bhatnagar view as well. She totally supported Saha. And she was critical about the fate of Indian science and Indian universities well into the 1960s. But by then, the damage had been done, resulting in the long-term neglect of scientific endeavor in the universities. So Amal had returned to India by 1950, and Nehru was encouraging her in his efforts to get her to relocate to India. She's meant to have met Nehru in 1948 on a plane, on a return journey from London, which is why she did not attend this particular congress, which I have a slide of, which was the World Genetic Congress in 1948. If you Google the video for this conference, it says that she was present at this meeting, but she was not. She was on a plane to India at this point. And you can see here, Darlington and Fisher, both very well-known eugenicists later, being part of the meeting, and Amal was missing at this meeting. So by the 1950s, Amal had returned to India, and she was very, very keen to resuscitate Indian botany and Indian science. In Dehradun, the Forest Research Institute, she persuaded the director to start research on cytology and breeding of trees and to begin work on sal and teak. She was actively involved in the Commission for Food Production in the early years, but was worried about Lysenkoish projects and the emergence of a pseudoscience in newly independent India. She was still undecided as to whether to return to England, nostalgically talking about her little attic flat in Wisley. This is when her nationalist aspirations seemed to have come to the forefront. And once again, she chose life and work in India above returning to England. She became part of the enterprise of a government-administered science, moving on to head the Central Botanical Laboratory in Lucknow, created in 1955. She was also to lead the reorganization of the Botanical Survey of India as a government-appointed advisor. Gradually, however, academic writing showed a disquiet with the government's increasingly dominant discourse of scientific industrialism. Her paper, as I said, for the Chicago meeting, detailed the subsistence economy of India and conceptualized the importance of ethnobotanical knowledge of India's tribal communities and its preservation. The trend in her thinking was to develop into an important critique of the government's developmental policies. Independence had seen many changes, including a further widespread destruction of India's forests. The destruction of forests, justified in the name of Grow More Food campaigns in the 1950s, upset Ammal. I went 37 miles from Shillong in search of the only tree of Magnolia griffithi in that part of Assam and found that it had been burned down, she noted. In 1955, after Ammal became the director of the Central Botanical Laboratory in Lucknow, the Ministry of Natural Resources and Scientific Research accepted a scheme for the reorganization of the Botanical Survey of India as an officer on special duty. For the purposes of the survey, she planned to divide India into six phytogeographical units, or circles, each with its own herbarium and a phytotaxonomic laboratory. She planned to have a central herbarium at either Calcutta or Dehradun. Her plans came into difficulties when the government appointed Reverend Shantapu, a Jesuit Spaniard and taxonomist of the old school, as director of the Botanical Survey of India. Janaki Amal was devastated, and she felt that her 2 years of work in India had been a waste of time. I quote, "I bring you news of a major defeat for botanical science in India. The government of India has appointed as chief botanist of India a man in the Kew tradition, and I, the director of the Central Botanical Laboratory, must now take orders from him. Kew has won a decisive victory, and the news has been jubilantly received there. I am very angry. As a systematic botanist, I have nothing against him, Shantapu. But I was hoping the Botanical Survey appointment, after its reorganization, would be something different from what it was in 1856, when Hooker wrote his Flora of British India. Kew has won, Sir Edward Salisbury has won, and we have lost. I feel sick. When I heard the news, I ran away to the wilds of Malabar to collect wild yams that our Aboriginal tribes dig up." Quote close. Abhiram and Outram have noted that obstacles to women's experiences of power within science were only matched by the ever greater obstacles of legitimizing such power once it accrued through success or prolonged service. The profound difficulty faced by women as holders of scientific authority may also explain their minor showing in major scientific debates, theoretical advances, or large-scale empirical projects, all of which required, it was deemed, potential and actual leadership of many men. They highlight the role of gender ideology in access to and pursuit of scientific careers. This fact could account for the curtailment of Ammal's leadership position at important junctures. Also important to note is the continuing influence of metropolitan science, in this case Kew, in the appointment of the director of the Botanical Survey of India. And that, in fact, post-independence, this influence continued. However, this reorganization of the Botanical Survey, I think, is extremely important legacy that she left the survey. And she made some very, very interesting comments in her memorandum for the survey. She wrote, I quote, "The plants collected in India during the last 30 years have been chiefly by foreign botanists and often sponsored by institutions outside India. They are now found in various gardens in herbaria in Europe, so that modern research on the flora of India can be conducted more intensely outside India than within this country. This is the most lamentable state of affairs. Only a reorganized and vitalized botanical survey can give fresh impetus to both collection and research." And this is absolutely true, because since Hooker's Flora of India, there's been no Flora of India, yeah, since 1870. And one of the things that my center does is we are trying to digitally repatriate the specimens and the Indian type specimens held in British herbariums. And so she was able to understand this and say that we really need to collect our own plants And we need to completely reorganize the survey accordingly. Amar had hoped that the headquarters of the reorganized botanical survey would also be in the home of the National Botanical Laboratory and would be transferred to Lucknow, from where all botanical studies in India would be coordinated. So she retires from the Botanical Survey in 1959 and was asked by the Council of Scientific and Industrial Research to help in their new regional laboratories. She then headed the botanical wing of the regional research laboratory in Jammu, becoming a leading figure in Indian science and working on a number of research projects and papers after her retirement. Her detailed letters to Darlington indicate the nature of her scientific experiments in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and her work on ethnobotany got a big boost with her study of medicinal plants when she went to travel to Nepal, and later on in the 1960s when she traveled to Ladakh. So briefly, if I've got 5 minutes or so, yeah. So I just want to say a little bit about Amal and eugenics and Darlington and Haldane. So while she actively pursued ethnobotanical interests, Amal was not averse to providing her colleagues with ethnographic details of tribes and castes. In 1960, Darlington returned to his old interest in the origin and structure of society, and his letters to Amal pushed her for information on caste in India, and in particular the distribution of criminal castes. He had moved on from the study of chromosomes to social genetics and to an interpretation of language, class, race, and society in biological terms. Darlington had always been interested in the link between man, culture, and biology. And in 1927, he had joined the Eugenics Society. Interestingly, in 1931, Amal joins the Eugenics Society, right? So it was widely appreciated among biologists in general that the neglect of the biological and genetical knowledge in modern legislation may lead to incalculable damage to our own people and to those of civilized communities. In 1937, the influence of Darlington on Amal is very visible when he sort of encourages her to collect such rather interesting data on hierarchies and racial and caste hierarchies. And for the first 40 years of the century, as Majumdar has noted, genetics was synonymous with eugenics. And she was part of this process. Between the wars, it is noted, it was still possible to be a scientist, a socialist, a meritocrat, and a eugenicist. The most advanced mathematical methodologies employed in genetics were embraced in the 1930s, by the critics of genetics, of course, people like Haldane and Penrose. But each in his own way was part of the eugenics movement. What was ironic was that these critics sought to produce a truly objective science of genetics by equipping themselves with methodologies created by the supporters of eugenics in Germany, where, as we now know, the program was pushed to its ultimate extremes. So Haldane is very much part of this, and he returns to India, as we know, as a third critical character in the story. And he mathematically dealt with the problems dealing with Darwinian variation and established the relationship of Mendelian genetics to evolution. But he was, of course, as I said, left of the eugenics movement, where Haldane completely embraced a very, very crude form of eugenics. And the relationship between Haldane, Amal, and Darlington, I think, is very interesting in this period, in the 60s, when they all sort of consorted with each other and developed very, very interesting ideas. Haldane, of course, took the Journal of Genetics when he moved to India in 1957 after the Suez Crisis, and he was instrumental in getting Amal to contribute to this journal on many occasions. So Amal, as I said, had been part of this growing interest in eugenics and its study and practice of selective breeding as applied to human beings. In fact, her interest in the study of tribes was to fuel part of this interest in eugenics. So what, finally, in order to conclude, national networks, the constitution of science at the end of empire. Amal's range of academic contacts and colleagues extended around the world. Her networks allow us to understand how science was constituted at that time of the time of Indian independence, and allows us to analyze the relationship between a metropolitan science and science in the periphery, both during and after colonial rule. Her extensive scientific correspondence from the 1940s to the 1970s extended to scientists and academics in institutions such as Kew, Edinburgh, in Edinburgh, Wisley, University of Sydney, and to individuals such as J.B.S. Haldane, H. Newton Barber, the professor of botany at the University of Sydney, who sent his student Constance Margaret Eardley, later to become lecturer in botany in Adelaide to work with her at Wisley, Pio Kolar, Hungarian geneticist, professor of cytogenetics in the Institute of Cancer Research in London, several Edinburgh and Kew-based botanists. So our global networks were really and truly global. And by forging new networks that spanned imperial space from the 1930s to the 1960s, she can be said in Lambert and Lester's terms to have altered the spatiality of empire in enduring ways. In such a conceptualization, imperial space is a sphere of multiplicity of trajectories, many of which were given impetus and direction by individuals collaborating in the pursuit of specific projects. That these networks of scientific inquiry included an Indian woman is telling of the ways in which internal frontiers of science and empire were reshaped by people who moved within, between, and outside of imperial boundaries. That these networks continued in the immediate post-independence period, altering only gradually, is indicative of the high esteem with which she was held. A study of these formal and informal networks has the potential of revising our understanding of science in the periphery in the early post-colonial period. Many practitioners of science such as Amal contributed regularly to scientific journals in Europe and North America and continued to be participants in a republic of letters that transcended national boundaries. In the later period, when the engenders of the nation-state took over, science moved along narrow paths driven by nationalist goals of self-reliance and import substitution, frequently at the cost of basic research. With the growing financial hardship of Indian universities and research institutions, this gulf was only to grow wider. So the last decades of her life were taken over by active research and her strident criticism of India's pursuit of scientific industrialism at all cost. She was too old to be employed by a CSIR, and she felt that she had not been given adequate recognition. She felt she deserved to be elected to the FRS, for example, as a fellow of the Royal Society. But one of the most brilliant things occurred at this time in 1970 when the cane that she had been experimenting on flowered, and she wrote a paper on this particular hybrid, which had flowered after several years. And she was ecstatic about the flowering after so many decades. And when she wrote the paper on the chromosome atlas of this particular hybrid, Darlington, her old friend, helped her to get it published in the Journal of Heredity. But he sent a note to the editor in his characteristic way. I quote, "I enclose for Heredity a paper which I have been fostering for 20 years. It has all the defects of India, but still I believe it ought to see the light since it describes the most remarkable plant hybrid ever produced." Right? So here is a plant that she has been nurturing and she's finally produced it, and he then patronizes her again. In the last decade of her life, Janaki was active as ever, writing papers, attempting a chromosome atlas of medicinal plants, but her work was taking new directions in the form of an environmental campaign to preserve the Silent Valley in Kerala, where the building of a dam on the Kuntipura River was part of a hydroelectric project. And here she is very, very passionate about working with people like Subramaniam, with people like M.S. Swaminathan and B.P. Pal to save the Silent Valley. By 1980, she has retired to Mudhra Vale, where she spends the last years of her life. And it's very interesting that even till the very end, she's trying to correspond with Darlington. Darlington, of course, dies before her. Amal died working in a research lab at the University of Madras on 7th February 1984. She was 87 years old, and several of her articles continue to be published posthumously. It's only recently that the government of India has recognized her. I take some credit for having organized the first Amal exhibition in Calcutta, which we've now opened it up to schools. Part of the exhibition was to take Hooker, this white male genius botanist, back to India, but the exhibition was complemented by the Amal exhibition. So you enter the the Botanical Survey of India Gallery at the Indian Museum. You enter this gallery first before you move on to the Hooker exhibition. So my final paragraph, was Amal a feminist in her approach to her life and career? Amal chose to live her life alone, devoted exclusively to science. She certainly did not see her problems as associated with being a woman in a man's world or being a non-white in an almost exclusively white scientific establishment. In any case, she did not articulate it as such. One could say that she practiced rather than preached feminism through a lifelong insistence and personal demonstration that devotion to science is not incompatible with a woman's gender. The problem, as one researcher has argued, is that women scientists most usually work in isolation and never address their problems collectively. A life of science but lived in isolation probably best describes her feminist choices. In the process, she reshaped the internal frontiers of science, empire, and nation in significant ways and helped to rethink the vision of India's national future as emerging from many sources that also embrace the tribal, the traditional, and the ecological.
Thank you, Vinita, for recovering such an interesting life for us.